This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the program, what are the expectations from the Pacific for next week's United Nations Summit on Climate Change?
As the Secretary General has said, the UNSG Summit will be a chance for leaders to bring plans, not speeches.
Also on the program, it is 20 years today since the Australian-led mission to Timor-Leste began after devastating violence there. We are going to hear about a unique project that's helping some of the Australian war veterans who've been permanently scarred by the experience.
I feel guilty about a lot of things. I guess I did what most soldiers do, you just push it aside and get on and try to forget.
Myself, I had really, really bad, horrific nightmares for 10 years.
We'll also hear from Australia's Defence Minister, who is in Timor-Leste for the anniversary. And she's also answered questions on how the Australian government has reacted to the Solomon Islands' decision this week to recognise China over Taiwan. And of course, we'll also take a look at the prospects for the Pacific teams at this year's Rugby World Cup that begins tonight. That's coming up later in the program. Good morning, I'm Catherine Grau. First, though, after days of heavy political lobbying, Tuvalu MPs have dumped Prime Minister Anele Sopoanga in favour of a long-term MP, Kausea Natano. Mr. Natano is the leader now of the New Look government in what is one of the world's smallest democracies. The outgoing Prime Minister, Anele Sopoanga, certainly made a name for himself as a climate change champion on the international arena. So questions remain as to who will represent Tuvalu in the international climate change space, and that comes as soon as next week's historic UN Climate Summit in New York. Here's Evan Wasuka with more.
He was Tuvalu's second longest-serving prime minister, but now Anele Sopoanga has found himself relegated to the opposition bench. Yesterday, 10 of Tuvalu's 16 freshly elected MPs voted for change, opting to end Mr. Sopoanga's 6 years as prime minister and vote in Kausea Natano. It continued a pattern of change that's been seen across other parts of the Pacific, with Nauru last month opting for a new president. Tine Leulu is the secretary to government and helped facilitate the secret ballot. He says there was heavy lobbying leading up to the election.
I think everyone is glad that it's over now, that people have been speculating since Saturday on who might come in, who might not.
Jessica Marinaccio is a PhD candidate in Pacific Studies at Victoria University in Wellington. She's lived and worked in Tuvalu for a number of years.
I think MP Natano, as Prime Minister, he has a lot of experience as an MP, as I said, and he served in different ministerial roles throughout his career. So I think he has a very strong understanding of how government works.
She says after many years, former Prime Minister Anele Sopoanga has found himself in a crowded field.
What we might be seeing here is the fact that there are a lot of people in Tuvalu, a lot of politicians who have various types of experiences who also think that they can do something for Tuvalu. Maybe something different, maybe something in a different way, and people see that too.
Internationally, Mr. Sopoanga's name has been synonymous with climate change activism. Earlier this year, he played host to United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres on his trip to the Pacific, and then in August, the leaders at the Pacific Islands Forum annual meeting. At the forum, he was a calm voice of reason between Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison and Fiji's Frank Bainimarama as Pacific leaders pushed Australia to make greater commitments on reducing carbon emissions. Ms. Marinaccio says it's hard to gauge if staging the forum had diminished Sopoanga's chances of getting back in.
I do think for the forum that Sopoanga was really strong on climate change, and that's something that people in Tuvalu always really appreciate.
She says the huge scale of the event may have also generated friction in the community. As for who will replace Mr. Sopoanga at the United Nations Climate Conference next week, where Tuvalu is a key player as chair of the Pacific Islands Forum, Tuvalu's most senior civil servant says it's still too early to say.
I think it is later in this afternoon when they have the first cabinet meeting. They will confirm actually who will be going in.
Ms. Marinaccio says it shouldn't be seen as the end of Mr. Sopoanga's role on the international climate change arena, as he may follow the example of another prominent Pacific climate champion, Anote Tong, the former president of Kiribati.
So I think no matter what happens with Sopoanga, if this is something he's really passionate about, he can continue to speak on this issue and he can continue to support Tuvalu in its fight against climate change. So I don't really think it will end up being a loss regardless, because I believe that he would continue to speak on this cause.
Thoughts of Jessica Marinaccio. She's a Pacific Studies researcher who spent a lot of time in Tuvalu. Our reporter, Evan Wasuka. Well, as we've just heard, the UN Secretary General will be hosting that Climate Action Summit next week, and a cohort of Pacific Islanders are heading there to add their voices to the call for big polluting countries to do more to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. Now, it won't just be political leaders, civil society groups and young people will be taking part too. Many are optimistic that the talks will result in a greater collective action to combat global warming, but some don't think that the region's biggest player, Australia, will contribute much to that effort, as Liam Fox reports.
The stated aim of the Climate Action Summit is to boost ambition and accelerate action to implement the 2015 Paris Agreement to combat climate change. To do that, countries are being asked to present concrete, realistic plans to build on their existing commitments to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 2020, to cut emissions by 45% over the next decade, and to slash them to net zero by 2050.
And as the Secretary General has said, the UNSG summit will be a chance for leaders to bring plans, not speeches. And so that we're really looking forward to hearing what exactly are the plans for a lot of these larger countries to lower their emissions and to really tackle the climate crisis?
Joseph Moyona Kolio is one of the Pacific Islanders heading to New York for the summit. He leads Greenpeace Australia's Pacific section.
It'll be a good opportunity for young people as well. There's the youth summit just before it as well, to really make a call to action.
The summit will take place just over a month after climate change dominated the Pacific Islands Forum in Tuvalu. At the forum, several Pacific leaders criticised Australia for trying to undermine a strong collective stance on the issue. Despite the friction, all members, including Australia and New Zealand, signed a statement, the Kainaki 2 Declaration for Urgent Climate Action Now. It says there is a climate change crisis facing Pacific Island nations, declares the need to limit the global average temperature increase to 1.5 degrees, and highlights the need to achieve net zero carbon emissions by 2050. The Forum Secretary General, Dame Meg Taylor, says the Kainaki Declaration could serve as an important statement for a joint Pacific position at the summit.
This will be a good guiding document in terms of how the Pacific positions itself in many international fora. But at the Climate Action Summit, very much so that this is a position that the region has taken, and that is a very valuable position.
As Pacific Island nations are among the most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change, Dame Meg expects Pacific voices to feature prominently in discussions in New York.
Hopefully many people, the public in Australia, in New Zealand and across the Pacific, are very supportive and are standing with us to make sure that we secure the future.
One of the aims of the summit is to encourage countries to build on their already stated plans to cut emissions by 2020, known as nationally determined contributions. But Joseph Moyona Kolio from Greenpeace isn't expecting much ambition from Australia.
We're always hopeful ahead of these things, but, you know, recent events tell us otherwise.
It's been reported in Australia that Prime Minister Scott Morrison will be in the United States at the time of the summit, but won't be attending. It's unclear if the Australian delegation will present a plan to cut carbon emissions beyond 2030.
It's Liam Fox reporting.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, as the dust settles on the Solomon Islands decision this week that dominated headlines, certainly here at Pacific Beat, when it decided to ditch its ties with Taiwan in favour of China, there has been further speculation as to how the move may impact the country. While the largest donor party partner for the Solomon Islands, Australia, has said that that decision will not affect its bilateral relationship, there have been threats of sanctions by the United States. Now, a Solomon Islands Central Bank report had predicted that could happen. It was leaked before the decision was announced this week, and in the report it warned that US retaliation could be catastrophic for the Solomon Islands economy. Meanwhile, as Priyanka Srinivasan reports, analysts are also pointing to the risks that are associated with Chinese loans.
China coerced the Solomon Islands to make this decision before the communist government's 70th anniversary on October 1.
Strong words from U.S. Congresswoman Ann Wagner, speaking before a House of Representatives committee in Washington. She questioned Gloria Steele from the U.S. Agency of International Development on whether Solomon Islands will be punished for their change in diplomatic relations from Taiwan to China.
Will any funding be directed to the Solomon Islands, which has just undermined U.S. strategic interests in the Indo-Pacific?
We are reassessing our assistance to the Solomon Islands at this point.
There's no need for that overreaction.
That's Solomon Islands opposition leader Matthew Wale, and he sees the change in diplomatic ties as a call for greater Pacific engagement by global leaders.
I don't myself support the decision, but the decision has been made. We've got to mitigate the risks that come with it and work from there.
Solomon Islands Central Bank forewarned the Sogavare government of the economic risk in cutting ties with Taiwan. In a leaked assessment report produced for the Prime Minister's office before the announcement, the bank said a switch from Taiwan to China would risk punitive action from Washington, action that would be catastrophic for Solomon Islands' economy. But Nilish Gounder, a senior lecturer in economics at the University of the South Pacific, believes such an outcome is unlikely.
It's not very clear what the U.S. has meant by sanctions, because these days sanctions are not really fashionable. If U.S. means trade sanctions, then that can have an impact on foreign reserves through a decline in exports to U.S., but I don't see that as a possibility.
And Mr. Gounder says the economic benefit offered by China may cushion Solomon Islands from the threat of U.S. sanctions. Some $500 million U.S. dollars has reportedly been promised in financial aid by Beijing, far surpassing the financial support offered Solomon Islands by Taiwan. But Mr. Gounder says there's concern that the aid may be offered as loans and that the country risks getting stuck in a debt trap.
There are countries which could fall into a debt trap in Pacific. And I think these countries include currently Tonga, Samoa and Vanuatu. I don't see Solomon Islands in the same league for now. However, if there are any funding arrangements for this switch, and if that funding arrangement consists of loans, then I would see Solomon Islands in a difficult position.
Taiwan's Deputy Foreign Affairs Minister, Dr. Su Shien-Su, has also raised concerns over loan repayments.
I heard that the Chinese government would like to provide $500 million U.S. dollars for your infrastructure project. How is Solomon Islands going to pay for that debt?
But while Solomon Islands may have turned their back on Taiwan, Palau's leader Tommy Remangasau Jr. has reiterated his country's commitment to the state.
But I think we've been very straight from day one. If we had a choice, we would be friends with Taiwan and China. It was not our intention to divide friends.
And Palau's President Remangasau's comments come as the Parliament of Marshall Islands unanimously adopts a three-page resolution recognizing and celebrating more than 20 years of ties between Majuro and Taipei.
Priyanka Srinivasan reporting there. Well, it's 20 years today since Australia led the international force into Timor-Leste in the wake of devastating violence that was waged by pro-Indonesian militias following a vote in favour of independence. But it's not just the Timorese who were victims at the time. Many Australian war veterans have paid a heavy personal price for the trauma and killings that they witnessed. So now a unique tour that's run by a former platoon leader is taking war vets back to help them confront and heal from the past, as our Indonesia correspondent Anne Barker reports.
We've got a whole lot of militia coming across the border.
On a remote hillside in Timor's south, a group of war veterans remember a young soldier shot dead near here 2 decades ago.
I come here last year for the first time in about 18 years.
Leonard Manning, a New Zealander, was part of the Interfet force that deployed to Timor 20 years ago as Indonesian-backed militias waged a campaign of violence against the Timorese. They shot Private Manning in the head during an ambush and slashed his throat. His superior, then Warrant Officer Phil Burgess, found his body and is still racked by self-blame.
I feel guilty about a lot of things. I guess I did what most soldiers do, you just push it aside and get on and and try to forget.
For years, Phil Burgess has struggled even to talk about the death. He was only recently diagnosed with PTSD. Veterans Care, an Australian non-government organisation, estimates one in six INTERFET personnel, most of them Australian, have suffered PTSD or some other mental trauma as a result of their deployment. An estimated 200 Australians or more out of the 30,000 or so who've served in East Timor since 1999 later killed themselves.
There's still a hell of a lot of veteran suicide in Australia. There's a lot of broken families.
Michael Stone, a former INTERFET platoon commander, knows firsthand the impact that military service can have on mental health.
Myself, I had really, really bad, horrific nightmares for 10 years. Episodes of psychosis where I was completely lost and like I was spiralling into an abyss.
Michael Stone says mental illnesses such as PTSD or depression have cost the careers of thousands of former INTERFET personnel. Many struggle to find other meaningful jobs and end up on medication. It was only when he returned to Timor in a civilian role, working for the Timorese, that Michael Stone discovered a more meaningful way to heal.
Doing things that are creating an impact, can reignite the fire in their belly, give them happiness and purpose, identity again.
Now, twice a year, he brings war vets to Timor on a tour called Timor Awakening that offers vets rehabilitation not only through group therapy, but by actively working with local communities. Within a few months this year, dozens of former vets have built a school from scratch for one small impoverished community at Same in Timor's south. Phil Burgess says the Timor Awakening tour has helped him find new meaning and purpose.
I had a lot of emotions. I was very angry, and probably angry for a long, long time. I would never forgive the Indonesians. Possibly through this program, I'm looking at doing that now.
And forgiving himself at the same time.
That is Anne Barker reporting there from Timor-Leste. Well, Australia's Defence Minister is Linda Reynolds, and she's in Timor-Leste this morning for that anniversary of the start of the Australian-led mission 20 years ago. The ABC's Sabra Lane spoke with Senator Reynolds a short time ago.
It is the importance of friendship and enduring military support and cooperation, which is what I've been discussing here today. But Sabra, the most important thing for me, the 20th anniversary itself, is that it's about the veterans. We've got 150 Australian veterans marching here side by side with their East Timorese counterparts, and also veterans from many of the other 22 nations that served here in INTERFET. So despite the difficulties and challenges, Australians today should remember what we did 20 years ago and the difference it has made to the lives of over a million Timor-Leste people today.
While you're in Dili, you're aiming to deepen ties with the East Timorese government. How?
I've had already had discussions with the President and also a very extended and very wonderful meeting with the Defence Minister. So while we talked about the past and about the 20th anniversary and marking that, we also talked about the next 20 years of defence engagement and relationship. And we've agreed on further deepening our defence cooperation programs on everything from joint maritime patrols in our common maritime borders. But we also talked about the Pacific Patrol Boat's capability that we are providing to Timor-Leste, which will be the gifting of two Pacific Patrol boats in 2023. So we talked about providing the training and also the port facilities here so that Timor-Leste has a truly sovereign capability.
The East Timor is also looking for $500 million to build a gas pipeline. Is Australia looking to help with that? And noting that the former Prime Minister John Howard says that Australia has an obligation to help East Timor with its economic future?
That is certainly the subject of discussion between Timor-Leste and Australia. But Australia would welcome investment from any partners, any global partners, as long as it's transparent, it upholds robust standards and international law, and also avoids unsustainable debt. So ultimately, this is an issue for Timor-Leste as a sovereign government.
On the region more broadly, and just touching on that issue, is defence looking at the strategic consequences of the Solomon Islands changing allegiances from Taiwan to China?
Well, Sabra, I was in Solomon Islands a couple of weeks ago, and that is clearly an issue for the Solomon Islands government. It's a sovereign interest and a decision for them to make. and it's really not appropriate for an Australian minister to comment on their decision.
Well, the United States could withdraw funds from the Solomon Islands. It's considering that. That would be greatly destabilising to the Solomons, and the Solomon Central Bank has warned it would be catastrophic. How prepared is Australia to respond if that happens?
Well, Sabra, as I said, I was up there a couple of weeks ago participating and it involved looking at some joint defence training activities. And again, that is a sovereign issue for the Solomon Islands government, and it would be highly inappropriate for me to speculate about what they or any other country may or may not do.
That's Australia's Defence Minister Linda Reynolds speaking there with Sabra Lane from Timor-Leste. Well, you may well know, and if you don't, you do now, the Rugby World Cup kicks off in Japan this weekend, and the Flying Fijians will be the first of the Pacific contingent to take to the field when they play Australia tomorrow. As Richard Hewitt reports, if Fiji play at their best, then some pundits think that they do have a reasonable chance of at least making the knockout stage of the tournament. But the outlook for Tonga and Samoa is not so great.
It's all over. Wales are out of the World Cup.
Incredible game. Fiji win 38-34.
One of the shock results in Rugby World Cup history when Fiji knocked out Wales in 2007. Now head of news and sport at FBC, Indra Singh reported on that game, and he says Fiji's success was all to do with targeting.
In 2007, because we beat Wales and that was the target that was set, that's how we managed to make the quarters. Now, have they set their sights on taking down Australia in the first game, or have they set their sights against Wales?
Well, it will be Australia first up, and with a form line that looks like a sine wave, much may depend on which Wallabies outfit turns up on the day, the one that beat the All Blacks or the one that was hammered by the New Zealanders just a week later.
On a day when Australia doesn't click and Fiji clicks, Fiji will take heart. I think Fiji would have worked on a few of the areas that they found loopholes with the Wallabies. Speaking from heart, every Fijian wants the team to beat the Wallabies. And the Fijians, once they get the ball and they start running, the backline is laced with world-class players. From 9 to 15, you've got players who could just blow any team off the park.
And certainly Fiji look like the team most likely to succeed from the Pacific. Uruguay and Georgia are winnable pool games. It's then a question of picking and hitting the right target. But what hope is there for Tonga, particularly after their recent drubbing by the All Blacks when they scored a solitary try at the death, but only after conceding 92 points?
Is Tonga, and they get in, and it's the captain.
And with England, Argentina, France and USA in Tonga's World Cup pool, former captain Inoki Afiaki says it's hard to be optimistic.
If you look at it at face value, you're looking at maybe just one team that Tonga's competitive against there, and that's the US. The rest, maybe a bridge too far, competing against countries that obviously play a lot and have time to pick very strong teams. And we're still scattering around the planet trying to sort out the players that are available for us.
So was it a mistake to take on the All Blacks so close to the World Cup in light of the potential damage to team morale?
I think this is the other school of thought. You play a good team to expose your weaknesses, and they showed us quite a few. Maybe athletes that are younger who will take that psychological pain and carry that with them for a bit, that could hurt them, but they've just got to realise that it's a blessing in disguise. In past World Cups, we've had a few players that have gone to sleep on the field, and this would have been a massive lesson to say that there's no time to fall asleep.
For Samoa, it's been a battle just getting to the World Cup at all, and again, expectations are not high. But during their recent encounter with Australia, the Manu showed what they can do, and World Cup veteran Earl Waar believes they can take heart from that.
Lilo gets it back on the inside to Ala, and my goodness, the replacement has got a double. Poatevao and Samoa all of a sudden are back in the contest.
We've had a good build-up of Pacific Nations Cup and in another game against New Zealand Development and finally against Australia a couple of weeks ago. After that game, they would have taken a lot of confidence out heading into the World Cup.
And if Samoa are to have any hope of a surprise quarter-final spot, with Scotland, Ireland and host Japan to come in their pool, they must beat Russia in their first match. But Earl Waar says, as ever, with the Pacific sides, they'll be playing with one hand behind their backs.
Players are still coming from all around the world. I feel for the coaches and the management team that have to put those sides together in such short notice and having to start from scratch.
And Inoki Afiaki agrees that the task ahead for all three Pacific teams is probably as difficult as it's ever been.
This will be the hardest World Cup, especially for countries like Tonga, Samoa, Fiji, who are just so far away from main competitions and they're isolated. I think the All Blacks played more than twice the tests going into this World Cup over the last 4 years, and it's just not looking good.
That is the former Tongan captain Inoki Afiaki there, Richard Hewitt. More on the World Cup with Talia Olatia up next.